welcome to the last of our legal ethics programs at Shaarei Shamayim for the academic year. I'm now looking for topics for the next academic year, so I'm going to request that in my follow-up email after the session. If you have thoughts for session topics we could be doing that fit within the general framework of professionalism topics, I'd certainly be glad to hear. There is one more program that I'm involved with. It's not the same as these, but a program on Tuesday morning, June 21st. It's being run by B'nai B'rith. It's oriented towards trusts and estates, although the topic this year has applications beyond that. It deals with prenuptial agreements, marriage contracts, with a slant towards inheritance, but it isn't only about inheritance, and I'll send out information about that, I expect, with the follow-up email from this session. If you didn't sign in, please make sure to sign in so you get the follow-up email, and especially if you want to have credit, I should note, because it came up at a previous session, if a husband and wife are here, they both need to sign in. Our records don't necessarily say that you were both here, and therefore we wouldn't be able to provide a confirmation letter should that become necessary. Okay, so the topic for tonight is access to justice, pro bono versus quid pro quo. And this is an issue which I started to research a few months ago in a different context when we were talking about the issue of ethical advertising. And the more I look at it, the more interesting it becomes. Where in the beginning I thought it was a relatively straightforward topic. But then I discovered the conflict, which you're no doubt familiar with, the conflict between pro bono and legal aid. The question of how much do we expect from lawyers in terms of how they are going to take care of the needs of people who are not able to afford representation, and how much do we expect from the government, and how much does the government expect from the lawyers, and how much do the lawyers expect from the government? I saw quite a few articles on the topic. One I referenced here in source number one on your sheet, Tension at the Border, Pro Bono and Legal Aid, from the CBA Standing Committee on Access to Justice. And here's the quote. There is an increasing and widespread acknowledgement among justice system participants that the problem of unmet legal needs in Canada is serious and growing, and significant effort is being dedicated to finding creative new approaches to solve the problem. Certainly, both pro bono and legal aid are aspects of that discussion, and the legal profession is an important participant. One unfortunate response has been to point the blame and responsibility elsewhere. Lawyers at governments demanding new money for legal aid, or judges and governments at lawyers demanding an undefined and seemingly unlimited amount of pro bono work. Underlying the finger-pointing are uncertainty and confusion regarding key issues that require further discussion and analysis. So the lawyers say we want the government to fund legal aid and pay lawyers to represent those who aren't able to afford it themselves, and the government says we want the lawyers to provide what's described here as an undefined number of hours that they're going to that will then meet the needs of the community. So what I want to do is discuss this in terms of three questions, which you see on your sheet. Number one, why does Jewish law permit a lawyer to charge for helping people? What I mean by that is, by representing someone, you're providing them what we call in Hebrew, chesed. It's an act of kindness. Are you entitled to say, I want someone to pay me in order to do something nice for them? Maybe you shouldn't be able to charge. Now, as is assumed within the question, the answer is yes, you're allowed to charge. But I want to develop that and the question of why it is that you're allowed to charge. That's number one. Number two, is it appropriate for the community to rely on pro bono work rather than increase legal aid funding? Is it appropriate for the community to say, lawyers, we understand this is your profession, which you normally practice for pay. Nonetheless, we want you to do it for free. That's the second question. And then the third, how does a lawyer choose pro bono cases? When the lawyer is faced with opportunities, whether it's opportunities between individual clients or opportunities to represent clients versus organizations, sometimes there are organizations that have a particular legislative agenda that they want the lawyer's help in promoting. How do you decide who should be your client? So those are the three questions that I'd like to address. But I go back first to the first question, and we actually had a class in this room. We were actually facing the other way. I was speaking on that side of the room. But it was the same theme for doctors, and the question of whether a doctor is permitted to charge. Because actually, when you deal with doctors, the question is not at all as straightforward as it is for lawyers. Meaning, you won't find any sources within the canon of Jewish law that say lawyers can't charge, they have to give away their services for free. You do find it regarding doctors. You do find such an expectation in certain sources. If you take a look at your sheet at source number 3, for those who are coming in now, the source sheets are there by the coffee on the table, as are the sign-in sheets. So source number 3 is from the Talmud. It's a Mishnah, so we're now going back to a source that was recorded officially in the 3rd century Common Era, but is actually much earlier. It says, Hamudar hana mechavero. The person takes a vow that I am not going to benefit somebody else. Two people are in some kind of a fight, and one of them says, he swears, I am not going to provide benefit for the other person. So the rule is, Merap Ehu Refuas Nefesh, he's allowed to heal that person's life, he can heal him medically, he's allowed to do that, but not Refuas Mamon, he's not allowed to heal his property, he can only heal the person individually. Why is it that he's allowed to heal the guy at all? If he took a vow saying, I'm not going to help you, healing that person is helping him. Why should he be allowed to? Why should he be allowed to heal him? What's the rationale? Your turn. What's the rationale in saying that a person who swore he's not going to help somebody is nonetheless allowed to heal him medically? Yeah.
You could say his life doesn't belong to him. His life is something that's from a shark.
So that's one interesting possibility. His life isn't his own, and therefore, you're not truly helping him personally. But I think, on balance, you are helping him. Even if it's not considered his own property, he's happy to continue living. What's the rationale for being allowed to help him in this case? It matters. This is an important point. It's because, fundamentally, you have a mitzvah of healing other people. You have a prior obligation. Just like I would not be allowed to swear that I'm not going to eat matzah on Passover, the oath would be meaningless. If I took an oath saying I was going to violate Shabbat, the oath would be meaningless. So too, if a person takes an oath saying that he is going to, saying that he's not going to help somebody else, that oath doesn't prevent him from healing him, because healing him is an obligation. You don't have a choice. That's the principle. And because it is a mitzvah, therefore it is argued one is not allowed to charge for it. Just as in source number 4, the Talmud states that when it comes to teaching people Torah, the rule is you're not allowed to charge people in order to teach them Torah. And indeed, we make all our classes available for free. So the rule is that you're not allowed to do mitzvot for people for money. When it comes to an obligation that you have to help somebody else, you're not allowed to charge for it. The Code of Jewish Law rules in source number 5 regarding the doctor, that the doctor is only allowed to take payment for strain and time lost from other pursuits. The doctor says, you know, had I not been healing you, I could have been fill in the blank. I could have been a stockbroker. I could have been whatever it was. So because the doctor is taking time away from other remunerative pursuits in order to heal the patient, therefore the doctor is allowed to say, I want you to pay me that which I lost, or because I had to strain in order to take care of the patient, therefore I'm allowed to claim payment. So that's the way it works when you're dealing with doctors. Well, if a lawyer is considered to be helping somebody else, then I go back to square one. Why is the lawyer allowed to charge? Why don't we say to the lawyer, just like the teacher of Torah, just like the doctor, you shouldn't be allowed to charge in the first place. The whole discussion about pro bono is irrelevant. Your entire practice should be pro bono. Why don't we say such a thing? And we don't. There is not a single source in Jewish law that says such a thing. What's the rationale? It's not just lawyers that this is confusing with. Let's say you own a supermarket. Right? You own a grocery store. You have food. There are homeless people around. There are needy people around all the time. Why am I allowed to charge people for food? Maybe I should have an obligation that I should take my inventory out into the street and hand it to people on the street and solve people's poverty problem. We know that that's not true. I brought you a source in source number 6, which says explicitly, forget giving it away, a store owner whose main support is from this source, meaning from the store, is not obligated to give his merchandise on credit. We don't compel him to help people in need by giving his merchandise away on tab. And it's not even as though anybody says, well, we don't like this, but we have to concede it so that there will be people who will enter this profession. Nobody even suggests such a thing. I'm not entirely sure why law should not be in the same category as medicine. Why isn't the store owner in the same category as medicine? Yeah. So you'll say it's because it's my needs versus their needs. In other words, if you're going to tell me I have to practice for free, then I'm not going to survive. So maybe there should be some minimum threshold. Like you're allowed to make X amount, and then after that, everything else has to be pro bono. But we don't find such an idea. I thought maybe you could argue that it's... Yes, the tax department does it. Well, I'm not going to go into that discussion. I gave a class last week on ethical taxation. We spent an hour and we didn't finish the topic. But perhaps, maybe it's because legal representation is not viewed as something that is life and death in the way that, healing a patient is. But then I go back to the supermarket case, where providing somebody with food could well be a life and death case. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure as to why we don't say this. Yeah? You have to give them... Yeah. Right, so that's true. You could make the argument regarding the supermarket that maybe as a rule we don't require the supermarkets to take off all the price tags or to extend credit. However, if they had somebody for whom it was life and death, maybe that would be their obligation. And maybe that really is the difference for law. Maybe the answer is law isn't, generally speaking, a life and death case. And let's say you had a hypothetical case. Let's say there was somebody who was up for the death penalty and didn't have proper representation. Maybe there would, in fact, become an obligation to represent that person. Maybe the argument could be made. I'm not sure. I have possible thoughts on it, but I think that it's important to start with this as we look at the topic in order to understand that fundamentally you have to ask yourself from a Jewish law perspective, if I am helping those in need, maybe I shouldn't be able to charge more. Maybe the assumption should be that everything should be pro bono, even though that isn't what we say in practice. Raquel. Yes.
And so you can monetize the time, right? You can monetize the service that you're providing.
Right.
And then we know, you can call it chesed, but it's really then a form of seduction, right? Like, it's, you're talking about basically giving someone something that has been monetized as far
right.
as value. And then there are halachic guidelines for how much stuff you can give. And you're not supposed to give, 100% of your money and what you have. There's a maximum. There might be a reason to think that you give some, or you should be giving some, but if you consider it as, if you frame it as a tzedakah, and we know that there are minimums and maximums, then there's no sort of problem that you'd be not able to give everything.
Right. You
would be not able to charge, you should be giving everything.
Right. So Raquel suggests, and this is something we're going to come back to, that maybe doing pro bono work is like tzedakah, it is philanthropy, and there we are told, in fact, that you're supposed to give 10% of your income philanthropically. That's 10%, not 50%. In fact, there is a maximum. One is not supposed to give more than 20% unless you're talking about somebody who really doesn't need the money at all. Then there's some discussion, but otherwise, there is a cap. So maybe that's the answer here. The thing is that what we're suggesting is that what you are doing is actually a mitzvah in and of itself of helping others. It would be under lo samar adam reyecha, not to stand by while somebody's blood is shed. It may not be subject to those rules. In the same way that for the doctor, it seems not to be subject to those rules. It's a good thought, and we're going to bring it in later, but I don't think it's relevant on this. So let's now talk about the issue of communal and private values and the issue of pro bono. First of all, the phrase pro bono, you know, is shorthand. The actual full phrase is... Yes? Right. For the public good, pro bono publico is according to Black's Law Dictionary anyway. As a matter of history, I brought you some sources on this. The practice of serving pro bono actually is very old. It goes back to the Roman Empire. If you take a look at source number 7 from an article called Mandatory Pro Bono in Civil Cases, he talks about something called patroni. The patroni were eminent private citizens who also were governmental leaders. As word of a patron's oratory skills spread, the number of his legal, quote, clients grew, including many who were not part of his household. The result was a new profession of trial lawyers born in the dependency of Roman classes cultivated by the state. That was one segment of the developing bar. In other words, the heads of household would actually represent members of their household as well as others as the reputation grew. Patrons represented their dependents without fee. And this pro bono tradition was difficult to dislodge when patroni represented clients who lived and worked outside the household. You say, you helped him for free, now help me for free also. Indeed, one commentator notes that during the Republic and early Empire, quote, we find no serious complaints that advocates' fees prevented the small man from litigating. So it apparently existed in Rome already. Now, with the rise of the church, ecclesiastical courts had their priests represent the needy for free. It was considered one of the duties of the priesthood was, in fact, to offer legal representation. And that became a practice not only in the ecclesiastical courts, but even in the secular courts, and it became English practice when Rome governed England. It was considered a duty. It wasn't even an act of charity. This is part of your job. 1424 is the earliest law that I could find that actually enshrined this idea of pro bono service. If you take a look at source number 8, this is an act passed by the Scottish Parliament in 1424. Thankfully, the source that I found turned it into modern English as opposed to what they had. If there be any poor person for want of sophistication or expenses that cannot or may not follow his cause, the king, for the love of God, shall order the judge, before whom the cause shall be determined, to obtain and get a loyal and a wise advocate to follow such poor person's causes. And if such causes are successful, the wrongdoer shall compensate both the party wronged and the advocate's costs in travel. So it's pro bono, but you may end up being reimbursed at least for costs. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not purely pro bono, but from what I understand, this actually happens today in pro bono, that sometimes someone will serve pro bono, and then if they win the case, the court actually will award costs, which matters because of a point that Jeffrey noted for me. Where's Jeffrey? He was here. There he is. Jeffrey noted for me a quirk of pro bono, that apparently there's some concern sometimes that if you're engaged in a lawsuit and you feel like you might lose, and the judge might award costs to the other side, so maybe you won't push as far because you don't want to run up the bill that you're going to end up needing to pay. But if you know that the opposition is being represented pro bono, then you have no fear of being asked to pay for costs, and therefore you'll actually go further. But this practice defeats it by saying you may have to pay costs, and that means that it actually turned out not to have been purely pro bono. Maybe that will help with the problem. But yeah, you're right. This ended up being something less than pure pro bono. But that's the law in 1424, and it's enshrined in England in law in 1495. And in fact, if someone refused to be appointed as pro bono counsel, they could actually be denied the right to practice. Like, they could be disbarred for refusing. King James does this in 1535. In American law, you have certain states where there actually is such a concept as well as assigning lawyers and saying, you're representing so-and-so. Now, in Ontario, there is no hard requirement for pro bono. All there is just a general sense of, we want people to do it. If you take a look at source number 9, in 2003, the CBA had a pro bono working group. Whereas the CBA has called for each member of the legal profession to strive to contribute 50 hours, or 3% of billings per year, on a pro bono basis. It's all over there. the 50, I don't know exactly where 50 hours came from as a number. I don't know if it seemed like a nice round number. I don't know if it was based on some kind of scientific calculation of the level of need within the community for pro bono work, and now we're going to divide it up by the number of lawyers we have. Does anybody know how 50 hours became the number? Yeah. Ah, so in other words, 1 hour per week is just what we're going to require. That's very interesting.
It's a week and a half billable time, 7 hours a day.
Aha. Uh-huh. Interesting. Do lawyers really only bill 7 hours a day?
Is that no. But that's usually a threshold if you're associated.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. Okay, so I've got some more information now. As we're going to see, the Law Society's rules of professional conduct encourage pro bono, but they don't state any sort of requirement. So where is it that this comes from? What's the basis for the values that create pro bono? Why should people engage in it? So there is clearly the personal value of philanthropy. The idea that you're helping other people out, this goes back to what Raquel referred to in terms of tzedakah, it is philanthropic, it is charitable, for me to see somebody in need and say, I'm going to help him out, he can't afford representation, I'll take care of it on his behalf. If you take a look at source number 10, an article from Melina Buckley called Moving Forward on Legal Aid. Might be Melinda, that might be a typo. But either way, what she writes is the following. Although there is clearly some overlap between the work of legal aid, which the community provides, and pro bono of the individual lawyer, they have developed out of somewhat different traditions. Early pro bono work by private lawyers was largely based on two principles, charity and professionalism. I'm going to come back to professionalism a little bit later. But charity and professionalism. The rise of legal aid, on the other hand, the idea of the government funding representation, was based on a concept of rights. That is, people are entitled to legal information and assistance. And we're going to come back to that, too. But for the moment, one basic motivation for pro bono is simply, be a good person. Somebody needs something, you can provide it. Go ahead and provide it. Within Judaism, we have the same idea, the same imperative to practice your profession in a way that will help others, even if we said before that it's not obligatory to do so. Now, there is actually a twist here when you deal with the Jewish obligation of philanthropy and representing people for free and the secular view. Because the general secular view is, the way it's just been presented, a personal obligation. There's an obligation of the individual to help people out. However, when you look at it from a Jewish perspective, what you actually have is a personal obligation and a communal obligation. In other words, it's a communal obligation of charity, of tzedakah. Take a look, please, at source number 11. I love this quote. This quote is from the Rambam Maimonides. He's talking about the ancient practice of a kupa and a tamchui. Kupa is the practice of collecting for people in need, collecting funds for people in need. Tamchui is the practice of collecting food on behalf of people in need. And that would be distributed at different intervals within the community. And Maimonides writes in source number 11, Mei olam lo ra'inu v'lo shamanu bekal mi Yisrael, she'la en kupa shel tzedakah. He says, never have we seen or heard of a Jewish community which lacked a communal tzedakah fund. There's no such thing as a Jewish community without a tzedakah fund. It's a hallmark of a community. It's not a community if it doesn't have it. I'll tell you as a side note, just because I saw the article again the other day. I saw it years ago, and then saw it again the other day, and I just loved it so much. After the earthquake in Japan, the earthquake and then the meltdown and so on, so there was a fund called the Japan Fund, which raised money. And there was an article in the New York Times about a month later about how it was difficult in Japan for them to learn to accept aid from outside. And they interviewed the head of the Japan Fund. And he described his experiences and how it was a process for him. And did anybody hear this? About this was great. He says in the article that they kept getting gifts in increments of 18. And he had no idea what this was until finally there was a Jewish person working at the fund who explained to him, yeah, those are Jews. That's what they do. Which I found beautiful. I mean, it's sad that they needed it, but it was just a beautiful thing. That's our trademark. We'll be recognized in this way. It was fascinating. If I remember, I'll send it out with the follow-up email. I'll send you the Japan article, too, because it was just great. It's the New York Times. You can find it online. Okay, but in terms of Maimonides' point, it isn't just that we give personally. It's also that we give communally. That's the hallmark of what a Jewish community is. And in fact, there is a communal obligation. Take a look at sources 12 and 13, please. There's a verse in Leviticus, in Vayikra, which speaks of the obligation to help others. And it says, if your brother becomes needy and his hand falls among you, that's an expression for becoming impoverished, you shall hold him, stranger or settler, and he shall live with you. Doesn't mean literally move into your house necessarily, but live among you. Number 13 is later in the biblical text, also about helping others. When there is a pauper among you, one of your brethren in one of your gates, in your land which Hashem your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart, you shall not clench your hand from your brother the pauper, for you shall surely open your hand to him, and you shall lend to him that which he lacks, which is lacking for him. Two separate presentations of the mitzvah of philanthropy, of helping others. Why does the Torah need two separate presentations? Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, in source number 14, the sheets are over there, says the following. These two sections, the two biblical passages, involve two separate duties. The tzedakah duty of the individual is learned from Deuteronomy, from number 13, which includes the command of you shall surely open your hand, and the prohibitions of you shall not harden your heart, you shall not clench your fist. Whereas Leviticus, you shall hold him stranger or settler, and he shall live with you, is addressed to the community. It speaks of the community's duty. In other words, there is not only a personal obligation, but there is a communal obligation. And if you go back to source number 13, you see something very interesting. Source number 12 just said that the duty is to help other people, provide them with their needs, survival. But if you look at number 13, you find a greater obligation. Right? Greater obligation. What is added in number 13 that wasn't in 12? Thank you, Jerry. What's called in Hebrew, de machsoro, that which he lacks. Meaning, whatever he is missing from his normal threshold of life, you have to give him. If he normally lives at a certain standard, that's what you're responsible to replace. The communal obligation is not that. The communal obligation is lower. Make sure people can survive. But if an individual is able to help to a greater extent, that's the individual's obligation. There's more to be said about that. But my point in bringing this is to show that there is an element of communal responsibility, so that the need to make sure that people can have legal representation is in Jewish ethics, is a personal obligation, and it's also a communal obligation. And that's an important point. So that's one reason for pro bono work. The idea that somebody needs something, I'm going to help them. Clear? So far, so good? Okay. There are other reasons for personal pro bono work beyond charity. There's the idea, of course, of self-interest. The idea that you get a good reputation, that you may get better experience. Sometimes people will volunteer for pro bono work in a new area, an area that's not their normal practice, in the hope that they develop some success in the field and it becomes an area of professional involvement as well. There's also the view that it's important to engage in pro bono work as a member of the profession. In other words, because I am a lawyer, because someone is a lawyer, because someone is a member of the bar, therefore they have to serve. If you take a look at source number 15, this is found in the commentary to the Rules of Professional Conduct. The rules state, a lawyer has a duty to uphold the standards and reputation of the legal profession and to assist in the advancement of its goals, organizations, and institutions. That's the rule part. Then, commentary. Collectively, lawyers are encouraged to enhance the profession through activities such as, and among them is, participating in legal aid and community legal service programs or providing legal services on a pro bono basis. In other words, it's about advancing the profession. It's important for the state of the legal profession that people provide pro bono representation. Why is that true? Why is it true that this is important in your role as a lawyer, that you should serve people sometimes for free? And this is not about philanthropy. Yeah? Public confidence in the system and confidence in the legal profession, what they called here the reputation of the profession. I think that's very important. There's also another issue which a fellow named David Scott pointed out in number 16, which is, you know, that lawyers are granted a monopoly. Well, they purchase by paying their fees to the bar, I suppose. But lawyers have a monopoly on providing legal representation. Sorry? What do you mean?
Because paralegals are regulated.
Because of paralegals, you're saying?
They have a certain field, certain number of fields in which they are allowed to practice just as much as lawyers.
Okay. But I would still just extend that. In other words, whoever is able to provide representation, by virtue of being a member of whatever professional group is allowed to do it, they have a monopoly. If I decided, you know, I think I know something, I've been teaching CPD group classes for a few years now, I think I know what I'm doing, I'm going to go out and represent some poor person who really should be getting somebody else. But if I decided I wanted to go out and do that, I couldn't do it. Well, if you want to have a monopoly, then you have to take care of the people who can't afford your services because you're not offering them any other way to get representation. That's the point that David Scott made in an address at the 3rd Annual Pro Bono Conference in source number 16. There is a responsibility because you control the delivery of services. So all of this is within the realm of pro bono and why a lawyer should want to engage in pro bono representation. But on the other side of it, there is a communal value that drives legal aid. And it's about access to justice. We talked about access to justice when we had the session on ethical advertising. But we'll go through a little bit of it now because this is really where the subject belongs. Society is expected to ensure that all citizens are able to receive justice. The goal is practical. You want to enable society to operate in a way that is fair. And this is something that has been discussed by judges over time. I'm not going to go through source after source on it, but I'll just note for you from the Rules of Professional Conduct in source number 17. A lawyer shall make legal services available to the public in an efficient and convenient way. The commentary says, as a matter of access to justice, it is in keeping with the best traditions of the legal profession to provide services pro bono and to reduce or waive a fee when there is hardship or poverty, or the client or prospective client would otherwise be deprived of adequate legal advice or representation. The Law Society encourages lawyers to provide public interest legal services and to support organizations that provide services to persons of limited means. From a simple, from the starting point that says that we want a society that provides justice for each of its citizens, we draw the conclusion that the community has to make sure that that option is available. The community does it via legal aid, but the individual as a member of the community is going to do it through pro bono. This is something that we find within Jewish law and ethics as well. If you turn to source number 18, you find the most simple source on the topic, a verse from Leviticus. Mishpat echad yeh lachem, you shall have one justice for yourself. Like stranger, like citizen. Meaning whether they're vulnerable, they're the stranger, they don't have the connections and so on, or whether they're an established citizen, doesn't matter. One brand of justice for everybody, for I am Hashem your God. God says, I stand behind this. That's the way that it's meant to work. So in part, that leads to pro bono, where individuals within society are expected to serve. However, it also leads, as I said, to legal aid. If you take a look at source number 19, Canadian jurisprudence regarding the right to legal aid, Indeed, in limited circumstances, in both criminal and civil proceedings, courts have recognized that individuals may have a right to government-funded counsel. Nevertheless, Canadian courts have rejected arguments that there is a general constitutional right to legal aid. That far they have not gone. You can't say my rights were violated because I didn't get legal aid representation. That does not work. However, there is a sense that it is important to society to make sure that there will be legal aid available. Now, that brings us to a question. That's in the secular system. In Jewish law and in Jewish history, do you have a concept of legal aid? Well, the answer is you wouldn't. Right? Why wouldn't you have a concept of legal aid historically within the Jewish community? We've said why before, in other contexts. There were no lawyers. There were no lawyers, meaning I didn't need a lawyer in order to go to a Beit Din, in order to go to a religious court. The concept of having somebody come with you who would help arrange your claims to be an Oreich Din goes back 2,000 years to the times of the Talmud. The phrase that is used in modern Hebrew for a lawyer, Oreich Din, is a Talmudic phrase. But there wasn't a requirement of a particular representative, and you didn't have them as paid professionals until modern times. So therefore there would be no legal aid of, we are now going to hire somebody for you. Jerry. Right, no, it's true. I should refine my statement. Not that there have... I should make clear and say, there has been no institution of lawyer, but Jews have been lawyers since biblical times. A fair point. He points out Abraham negotiating trying to negotiate the agreement with God on behalf of the city of Sodom. So fair enough. We have been lawyers, even though our community did not have any lawyers. This is true. But the idea of funding the position didn't exist. However, what did exist was funding the position of judge, making sure that there would be enough judges available so that people would be able to go to court. If you take a look at source number 20, it refers to something called the half shekel collection. Going back to biblical times, they did a census of the people, and it was a military census, so they had each member of the military contribute the same coin, a half shekel coin, and that money then went for communal purposes. Now, in the original collection, it went for the construction of the temple the Jews used in the wilderness, the Mishkan. In subsequent years, it went to provide temple sacrifices, but it came to be used for other communal needs as well, including what you see here in source number 20. Gozrei Gzeirot Sheyushalayim, the authors of decrees, which is a reference to judges, in Jerusalem, would collect wages of 99 maneh, a unit of currency, from the half shekel collection. Every year, the judges in Jerusalem were paid by a communal fund. But it wasn't only Jerusalem. If you go to the next source, and the Talmudic source you're talking about is going back a couple of thousand years. The next source I'm bringing is quoting Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona, which goes back about 800 years, referring to a practice that he witnessed. Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona wrote, "The practice in many places is to make a collection for the court, dispensing their food and support as needed per year. They collected it at the start or end of the year." You were funding the position of judge because you wanted to make sure that judges would be available. It wasn't a concern for bribery, let's avoid having them be bribed by people and so on. There was the option of taking payment from the litigants if they wished, as long as they took from each side equally. If you're going to be bribed by both, no. The idea was that the sides would pay equally, but if you're going to rely on that as your system, if you're going to say the litigants on each side pay us, then what happens when litigants don't have the funds to be able to do so? So therefore, the community funded the position of judge in order to ensure there would be access to justice for everybody. And we had similar taxes on the community for other causes. I brought you, I think, another source here, number 22, which I'm not going to go into because it raises other questions. But it shows the way that they would tax the community for such public causes. So, to summarize what we've said so far, and I brought it on the sheet, in number 23, there is, within Jewish ethics as well as within secular ethics, a communal duty of access to justice. We want to make sure that everyone is able to benefit from the legal system, everyone is able to have representation. Number two, there is a personal duty of philanthropy. I have to help people if it's in within my means of doing so. We'll have to talk about how much in a little bit. And then there's a communal duty of philanthropy, but that is for basic survival. That doesn't necessarily speak to a legal aid obligation. That was the distinction we made between the two biblical sections, and we said the communal duty is basic survival, not a higher standard. Is what we've said so far clear? Questions or comments on what we've said so far? Yes?
I think one of the cardinal differences, just to put things into perspective, is that in biblical times, the system of judges was an inquisitorial system.
Yes.
Right? So where the judges would try to get to the truth. Here is an adversarial system.
Right.
The common law system is very different.
Correct.
Because the role of the judge is not to insert himself or herself into the dispute, but rather to hear both parties and give an equal opportunity to be heard.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. The systems are different without a doubt. And certainly when you're dealing with an adversarial system, it becomes much more important that you have a lawyer.
Right.
Right. Agreed. So let's get back to our questions then from the start. We have two questions that we need to address. One question is one question is, may the community rely on the lawyer and say, you do pro bono, or does it have an obligation to increase legal funding? We've seen over time, and I brought you a source for this in, I didn't bring it on the sheet. I should have brought it on the sheet, but it's in the source I'm thinking of comes from the article I quoted in number one, Tension at the Border, that logically a resurgence of pro bono leads to a decrease in funding for legal aid. As the government says, well, if we don't need to spend on that, then we will not spend on that. But the fundamental question is this. If the Jewish understanding of my duty to help with representation is both personal philanthropy and communal access to justice, if we have both elements involved, then how much falls on each side of the equation? And there are really three questions that we would need to ask in that regard. And those are the questions that I put in number 24. We have to ask ourselves, is a lawyer allowed to shift the burden to legal aid? And may the community require lawyers to serve pro bono? That's one question. Number two, is the community required to take steps to encourage pro bono, such as by providing tax deductions or tax credits for efforts that the lawyer makes in that regard? And if pro bono services would be inferior to legal aid, right? Why might pro bono services be inferior to legal aid?
Because the lawyer's doing absolutely nothing.
Because he knows he's getting nothing in response, right, for his work. And because we already mentioned the possibility that the lawyer says, I'm going to use pro bono as an opportunity to broaden my expertise. I'm going to do things I would never dare to do if someone were paying me. But I'll do them now, pro bono. So if there is a sense that pro bono services are going to be inferior to legal aid, is the community obligated to pay for better representation? To say, we're going to provide legal aid. Those are our three key questions. So this is hotly debated in secular ethics. All of these issues are debated. I saw a number of articles which all basically follow the same mold. They lay out the arguments for one side, they lay out the arguments for the other side, and they say, don't know, we have to figure this out. I haven't seen anybody actually come to practical resolutions, which makes sense because these are hard topics. But if we apply the idea that legal aid is part of a community's obligation to ensure access to justice, and the idea that pro bono is my personal philanthropy, then we can start to address practical questions. Number one, in terms of the balance between the expectation on the community and the expectation on the individual, the government may expect lawyers to do a certain amount as their tzedakah, as their philanthropy. We already quoted the 10% number, which I'm going to come back to. Beyond that, though, the community raises the funds as a tax. Now, that tax may be collected from lawyers as well. In other words, they're going to turn to the lawyers and say, we want you to pay this also. But it is, in fact, it would appear, the community is within its rights to say, we want lawyers to give X percentage. X percentage is more likely to be 10% in Jewish ethics than the 3% of billing that we mentioned before. And that would be what they would expect, and they would calculate. We have X number of lawyers multiplied by whatever we're going to get out of 10% of their billings, and that's what we're going to expect to be the pro bono share of the burden, and then we'll do everything else. That would be the calculation, I think, within a Jewish ethical system of the balance between pro bono and legal aid. Clear? That's on that item. In terms of our second question, is the community required to take steps to encourage it? I think so, because the community has its own responsibility, and yes, the community would be responsible to take steps to increase the pro bono work. In terms of the quality issue, I think it's true that the government should not depend on pro bono if it can do legal aid. Assuming the tax money is there for them to spend, then they should not be relying on the pro bono if they feel that the pro bono, in fact, would be inferior to the legal aid work. First of all, because it may, in fact, be inferior, but I would also note source number 25. Source number 25 deals with an interesting quirk of Jewish law, something you're never going to see in secular law, I think. Not directly, anyway. The Torah states that in the event that one person wounds another, he's obligated to pay for damages. Damages take five forms. There are five types of damage that one is responsible to pay. There's nezek, which means depreciation of the person's value. What that means is a discussion for another time. Tsar, pain. Ripoy, medical bills. Shevet, time lost from work. And boshet, humiliation. You have to pay for all those different five types of harm that have been committed, to whatever extent they have been committed. But one of those, we said, was medical bills. But the way it works, traditionally the way it worked at any rate, was you actually found the person a doctor. You hired a doctor for the victim. So the Talmud entertains the question, what if your brother's a doctor? And you say, you know what? He'll take care of you for free. And that way I don't have to pay him anything. And on that, the Talmud comments, source number 25, if an assailant says, I will bring you a doctor for nothing, he, the victim, may reply, a doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. He's allowed to make that statement. And the same thing would be true when it comes to legal representation. He's going to say, I want the government to invest in legal aid because the lawyer who's going to represent me for nothing is also potentially worth that. So the community will not be allowed to say the exact calculation that we just gave. When we said the community can say, we have X number of lawyers who have Y number of hours to give. That's what we're going to assign to legal aid and then forget about it. According to this point, if there really is a concern that the legal aid will be superior and that the pro bono will be truly inferior, it's not up to the standard of what one should expect. Just for basic representation, I don't mean he's not going to be the best of the best, but if it won't meet the level of normal representation, then the community would not be able to rely on it. Clear so far? Good so far? Okay. So that's in terms of the community versus the individual lawyer. And it brings me to our last area, the area of the lawyer's perspective. And how does the lawyer make his own assessment of cases to accept and of time to commit? So the first question that I have here, number 26, is how much time does a lawyer have to commit to pro bono within Jewish ethics? We've already seen the CBA say you should strive for 50 hours, 3% of billing. Right? It didn't say whichever is greater or anything like that. I don't know which number they really want. But if you take a look at source number 27, you find the basis for saying that from a Jewish ethics perspective, it should be 10 to 20%. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, a leading authority in Jewish law in the U.S. for the latter half of the 20th century, passed away in 1986, was asked this question by a rabbinical student. He's spending his time on his own studies, and he's approached by other people to help them in their studies. And his question is, I understand that I should be helping other people. What percentage of my time am I obligated to commit to educating others? That was the question that he put to him. So Rabbi Feinstein responds, to me it seems logical to say it is the same threshold as for Meiser, for the practice of tithing to help the needy. 10% of the time he has available to learn Torah, should say learn, not lean. Perhaps he could add up to 20%. The threshold requires thought. And the reason he says up to 20% is because the Code of Jewish Law, when it deals with tzedakah, with helping other people financially, it states that the obligation is that a person should give 10% of one's income and up to 20%. So he says, let's apply the same principle there. What if somebody does more? Yeah. Correct. Good. So Raquel points out that we're doing it as a time assessment here, not as a financial assessment. And you're 100% right. In other words, the principle is that people should give 10% of their time to help others, separate from their obligation to give 10% of their income to help others. It's a separate calculation. So you want to know how much time should I be volunteering for causes? 10%. Which I think is more than I think most people do. Whether you can buy hours, I don't know. I don't know if it's a give or get type of a deal or something. But that's exactly what Rabbi Feinstein is proposing here. It's 10% of time, and it's also 10% of one's money, which leads to a very interesting calculation set by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was a leading rabbinic authority also latter half of the 20th century into the beginning of the 21st, in his case, in Israel, where he said the following. If a person does more than 10% of their hours, they can value what they do over the 10% and use that number of what it would have been worth as the equivalent of a financial contribution. And what they do is, they ask themselves, how much could I have billed for these hours? So use round numbers. Let's say they could have billed $100 an hour, and they did 3 hours above their 10% that week or whatever it is. So they can view it as having done $270 in contributions to tzedakah, to charity. 270 rather than 300. Why? Why 270 rather than 300? Yeah. Exactly. Had you made $300 for that time, you would have had to separate 10% and give it away. So you really only have given away 270. Thank you. Yes?
You suggest that if I coach a baseball team, it'd be actually out of school.
Excellent question. So Paul asks, how far can we go in terms of our volunteering efforts? What is considered chesed? What is considered kindness? Hold the question for a minute because I'm actually going to come to that. I'm not a mentalist. I didn't know it was going to be a baseball team, but I had the question in mind. Overall. So we're going to come back to that in a moment. But the basic principle of how do I calculate my time that I'm going to commit to pro bono, it would seem that since it's a function of my personal philanthropic obligation, it's a 10% responsibility that does not absolve me of my 10% of income responsibility, but it can translate over. So, the second question, and this is the big one, how do you prioritize causes? How do you decide whether you're going to represent an organization, an individual, what kind of organization, what exactly qualifies from a Jewish law perspective, criminal versus civil? So, a couple of principles. First of all, we prioritize based on level of need. That's a general rule. When it comes to philanthropic causes, we always look to help people with real financial need first. That's number one. Number two is that we prioritize based on geographic area. If you take a look at source number 28, the top of the last side, Rabbi Yosef taught, if you have a choice between your own poor and those of your city, choose your own poor first. Meaning that if a person has relatives, a person has people he's close to, and they are in need, you take care of them first. After that, the residents of your city, if you have a choice, bless you, between the poor of your city and the poor of another city, choose the poor of your city first. And where he gets it from, bless you, where the source for this statement is a verse that we actually saw earlier. If you go back to number 13, the opening of that passage said, when there is a pauper among you, one of your brethren in one of your gates. So among you suggests that it's family first, one of your brethren, and then in one of your gates, somebody who is local. And that's the priority. There is an idea which is post-Talmudic, which also suggests, bless you, that Israel would have priority before other areas. So you get a hierarchy that tells us something about what we're supposed to do. Number one, the greatest need comes first. And number two, the ones who are closest to you geographically come first, and the hope is that if everybody takes care of those who are geographically closest to them, then everybody will be covered. Even though everybody knows that you will never reach a state in which everybody is taken care of. The biblical verse actually says, "Lo yechdal avyon mikarav haaretz." There will never be a situation in which all poverty is eliminated. Nonetheless, the biblical verse continues to say, therefore I'm telling you, open up your hand and help. You can't give up. So, if we're saying that priority is for the most dire need first, and priority is for local first, how does that translate into action? Especially because if you're really going to give all of your help just for the hungry, just for people who don't have food, the reality is that there are many causes that will simply disappear, right? If the federal budget and the provincial budget would all go into taking care of the homeless and taking care of the indigent, the result would be that you wouldn't have, let's say, arts funding at all. Now, for some people, that wouldn't change their lives one bit. But for some people, that's a very big priority. You know, community parks and playgrounds. For some people, they'd say, well, I'd rather feed the homeless. But for other people, once again, it's a priority in order to have a society, and so on, with many services that we rely on the government for. So Rabbi Moshe Heineman in Baltimore came out with a set of guidelines that he suggested years ago, which is still the best set of guidelines that I've seen. And I summarized some of it in source number 29. I gave you a link where you can see it in full. Now, those of you who received the source sheet in advance, you can click on the link rather than have to retype all of that. But I'm also going to send it out, I expect, with my follow-up email, so those who didn't already have it will have it then, and you can click on the link and see it. The problem is that the website Just Tzedakah doesn't exist right now, so you have to go to archive.org in order to find it. In any case, what he promoted is the following. He said, first of all, make sure that 50% is used locally. He says, the majority of one's funds should go for local causes. Separate from that, he said that one should divide the causes one supports into thirds. And here's where we get back to the baseball question and the question of what exactly counts. The first one-third, needy individuals or institutions that actually help the needy. So places that will provide food, places that will provide shelter, basic needs. He says one-third of one's philanthropy should be on that level of need. The next third, he says, moral obligations. Now, he's not talking about pro bono work. He's talking philanthropy in general. So what he has in mind is relatives and close friends, but also organizations from whom one has benefited. The school I send my children to, something along those lines. He says you have a moral obligation to certain institutions. And then, the next one-third, any qualified individual or institution, all while making sure that 50% goes local, but that's his way of framing it. I bring this here because I think that it's instructive when we make the decision of how to choose causes for pro bono work as well. Meaning, there will be all sorts of organizations that are lobbying for important things. They, whatever those important things may be, they want certain freedoms protected, they want certain laws changed, and they are needy in the sense that they can't afford representation. On the other hand, this isn't about putting food on the table. So what I would suggest is that from a Jewish ethical perspective, my priority is to use my pro bono hours for individuals in need and not to throw all of them into representing agencies and organizations. But on the other hand, not to ignore the needs of the organizations either, just to say they're not the highest priority. They would come after the emphasis on helping the needy individuals with at least that the first third, and I think probably the first two-thirds. They are really for the needy. And I should make sure it's for those who are local before it is for those who are further away. Now, Paul's question was, well, what about the baseball team? And how do I evaluate what qualifies as needy? So my assessment would be, and this is just my off-the-cuff assessment, which is always very dangerous, so this doesn't constitute legal advice, and it doesn't constitute halachic advice. This constitutes a gut feeling, is that if you could demonstrate that this met a basic need for the kids, something that mattered for their development, and it was something which the community baseball league could not afford to get a coach, you're not going to be able to find somebody, then I think that you do have a very valid argument that this qualifies as the 10% of your time that you're giving to tzedakah. I think that it does qualify, and more, if the event that you weren't the best baseball coach in the world, let's say you were me, and you wanted to say, I'm going to contribute funds to hire a coach, then that would count as a tzedakah donation as well. So that's an interesting question. Does it have to be billable hours in order for it to qualify for the 10%? It's a really good question, especially because in the articles I read on pro bono, one of the points that they made was that lawyers will often use hours that were dead hours anyway. It's not time that they would have been able to use for paying clients anyway. So it's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. That I want to think about a little bit more. Does it have to be, so to speak, a billable hour in order to qualify? Yes?
So a lot of the pro bono discussions that you see before you are with respect to people who have insurance. There's a lot of lawyers who don't have insurance, and I'm wondering how that fits into your obligation. So lawyers who are on maternity leave, lawyers who are retired, lawyers who are in this sense of...
Right.
You don't have the same support that you would if you're at a firm where you can kind of get support from other places where you have...
Right. So the question was, what about a lawyer who does not have insurance? They're on maternity leave or whatever the case may be, and would they then be expected to provide this kind of pro bono help? And the answer is no. Not speaking from a legal perspective, although I did see this discussed in some of the articles, and basically the articles that I saw mostly said that the government should really be looking to provide insurance for pro bono work. Yeah. Right. And from a Jewish ethics perspective, taking it and applying it to the tzedakah discussion, one is not supposed to give if it's going to endanger oneself. And that's what you're talking about. You don't want to do this without a net. So the answer is no. One would not be obligated to do so. Jeffrey, you were going to say? You don't think you're allowed to without insurance? Okay. In that case, it covers it as well. Like driving a car. Okay. Other questions? Then to summarize what we've said, yeah.
The whole discussion, there's a bit of a disconnect here, because really, not everyone can get pro bono services. It's a relatively narrow slice of the legal community can give pro bono.
you have your criminal lawyers, many of whom use legal aid because legal aid is really geared to criminal law, and then you have lawyers who practice civil litigation who would have the greatest potential to be able to provide pro bono work.
Right.
But so it sort of leaves like probably the majority of lawyers off the hook for the obligation, and I think there's a bit of a disconnect there in terms of discussion, and particularly the last thing of the third year.
So it's a good question. The question that was asked is, what about a lawyer whose field of expertise is not a field that's going to have pro bono possibilities? A lawyer works in mergers and acquisitions. A lawyer works in home purchases and real estate. So you know, what are they going to do for their pro bono? So I would say two things. Number one, we did note that it is popular among lawyers to actually expand their field when it comes to what they do pro bono. I don't mean to expand it irresponsibly and say, well, I guess I'm a family lawyer now. but to expand in a responsible way if that's practical. I think that's one point. The other point is that the 10% obligation is not really an obligation of my function as a lawyer. It's a 10% of my time in general obligation. The reason it comes into law is because the lawyer who is capable of using law to help others has that as part of their philanthropic obligation, just like a human being with money has the obligation to help others with their money. It's a currency they have. If you have a currency that's useless for people because, you know, let's say you have Canadian dollars and you go somewhere where they don't know from Canadian dollars, so you have no obligation of giving 10% of your Canadian dollars to people who have no use for them. Then you find some other way to be of assistance. So I think your point is well taken. This is the substance of it becomes academic when you're dealing with lawyers who are not in a position to provide pro bono. But I think that it's still important to recognize the expectation on our time from a Jewish ethics perspective, the general expectation of access to justice expansion, and the possibility that a person who went to law school and qualified for the bar, may have the ability to expand what they are able to do in a responsible way and provide broader services for others. That would be the suggestion I would make. How practical it is, again, I'm not a lawyer, so it's very hard for me to say. My wife started originally in trusts and estates. That was what she worked for initially, and then she found herself in IP law, and she does patents. And you know, thank God, I think she's great in both. I'm on record here. I do realize that that's not something necessarily that's I realize that that's not something necessarily that is an option for every lawyer in every field. Yossi.
Charity, whether it's giving them a job or something along those lines of reasoning. So I think applying that here, it doesn't pro bono and from the form of charity, it doesn't necessarily have to be criminal law or someone's getting sued if you're defending in civil litigation. It can even be from a business law perspective, providing services to someone so that they don't fall below that poverty threshold and need charity.
Right, no, it's true. I mean, the issue of helping the needy, I had underlined the importance of helping people who need food and who have that level of need. But you're certainly right that you can make a major impact on somebody with pro bono work in other areas, including business representation. But again, I leave it to the lawyer to know his own to know his own portfolio and his own field and figure out whether this applies and how it does. I think it requires a degree of sophistication in the field in order to really know what the potential applications are. And there's an expectation that people will think creatively in order to find the ways that they're able to assist. Yes?
Just some practical considerations here.
Immigration law. Yes.
No.
Oh, okay.
When you're representing somebody pro bono or a regular client, the paying client, you, technically speaking, you need to provide the same level of service, apply the same level of knowledge, and you're subject to the same obligations. So, for example, if you're representing somebody in, who's on pro bono, on a pro bono basis, you still have to do the same amount of work for the case, depending on the, comparing apples to apples, I would say. You have to, exercise the same level of care and professionalism, etc. Okay? So, but you are getting nothing in return. Like, you may get satisfaction, you may get something, but practically speaking,
your wallet isn't getting anything.
Your rent. Yeah. Okay? So, is there any kind of concept in which lawyers can be protected in Jewish law, for example, because it's not a secular law, if, for example, they say, okay, I'm going to help you, but only so much. I'm going to help you to this point. Or I'm going to help you only, but I cannot spend more than X number of hours, even though the case may require more.
Right. So that's a good question. The question is a lawyer able to say, I'm going to help pro bono, but I'm only going to give you this number of hours or this level of service or whatever it is? So I'd say two things. First, in terms of your earlier comment about the lawyer's getting nothing out of it, maybe he's getting reward in the next world or satisfaction, I should note that the articles I read about pro bono and why people engage in pro bono and why law firms will require pro bono and so on actually emphasize that firms that do more pro bono tend to have higher degree of satisfaction among the lawyers who work for the firm, and they tend to attract some of the higher end students coming out of law school who find that to be something meaningful for them. So I should note that we shouldn't play down the satisfaction element. Having said that, in terms of your question, I go back to the point that we made about the individual's obligation versus the community's obligation. And we said that the community's philanthropic obligation is to provide people with survival. The individual's philanthropic obligation, assuming the capacity is there, is actually to restore them to their normal level of existence, whatever their living standard was before things went bad. So I think on that basis, I would suggest that the goal really is to provide them with the same level of legal services that they would get if they were paying for it. However, the lawyer's obligation fundamentally is the 10% of his hours. And he is, from a Jewish ethics, and I'm not speaking now to what secular rules are going to do and whether the government is going to look kindly on a lawyer who does this, but from a Jewish ethics perspective, he would be entitled to say, I have 20 hours to give right now in my account of hours for this. That's what I'm going to give for this case. And then I'm going to hand it off to whoever you find next, and I'll give him all the files and everything else, and he'll pick up from there. Or you could wait another week, and then I have more hours to give, and I'll do it that way. Hypothetically, yes. Practically, I don't know that this works in the realm of law. I don't know that this is a good idea. I don't know that this is particularly helpful for the client. The client may be better off not having gone that route and instead waiting to find somebody else who will provide them with full services. There is potentially a possibility of banking one's hours within the Jewish system, meaning it's to take this to the financial tzedakah realm. I know that I'm going to make X number of dollars in a given accounting period. I haven't yet made that money. I can give now what will end up being 10% of the whole and then not owe anything for the rest of the accounting period. It's possible for the lawyer to say, this case is going to take me 100 hours. Realistically, I only owe about 20 hours right now. But I am going to do the 100 hours for this case, and it simply means I don't owe anything for pro bono going forward for the next, until I build that up. It's possible for him to do that. I think that's better for the client than saying 20 times up, now I'm going to move on to other clients eventually when they come around. That's what I would say. Jerry. Yeah.
Off.
Right. So Jerry suggests pro bono associations, equivalent to charity clinics in medicine. So I believe I have come across references to those sorts of associations. Those do exist. I don't know how it works in terms of continuity of care, privacy, conflict of interest, and so on. Like, I imagine that can be a headache because, you know, now it's hard enough to find, you know, one firm without a conflict of interest. Now you may have to find multiple. I don't know how that works, but that's, you know, it is a practical reality. Yes, and then? Right.
Lawyers from the department never would be able to have the advantage of their keeping track of their time.
Right. So within a firm, you can have that set up. Okay. Yes?
In a modern context, the ratio is 10% up to 20%. How do those interact in conjunction with your obligations to pay taxes? So, for example, let's say that someone earns X dollars and you're total tax rate ends up being 35% to 40%. By the time they're finished paying their income tax, their HST, their municipal taxes, so on and so forth. Now, if you add, let's say, 15% to that, you're already at a 50%, 55% level. Then, of course, you have to deduct your expenses as a practitioner. So at the end of the day, there's really not very much left. So I guess my question is, In ancient days, where the 10% or 20% wasn't necessarily in conjunction with the 35% marginal tax rate, how does it sit today?
Right. It's a very good question. So I would say two things. Number one, it actually was pretty onerous back in the day as well, because the tax that you were giving wasn't only the 10% that we're talking about. You also had all the tithes on produce. I mean, Israeli produce has taxes of 2% that goes to the Kohen, to the priest, another 10% that goes to the Levite, another 10% that is either consumed in Jerusalem or given to the poor, depending on the year. The first fruits have to be given. All sorts of different tithes and taxes. You end up actually with a pretty high marginal tax rate in its own right. That's number one. Number two is, like any good tax system, the Jewish income tax also has deductions. So, for example, that which one pays in income tax to the government is deducted before the 10% comes out of it. So it's a 10% net, not a 10% of gross. So that ends up knocking out a good chunk of one's income, unfortunately about 35 to 40% potentially, from the calculation. No, but the answer is that it can be done. You know, as someone who's giving somewhere between 30 and 40% of his income for day school tuition and high school tuition right now, I can tell you it still can be done. But this is an expectation that that Jewish ethics has for people, and hopefully they live up to it. So I'm just going to summarize because we're getting towards the end, and then Jeffrey has an announcement to make, I think. Right? Okay.
So, let's say 100 hours is what I've required you to be sure. And you said it's 0 from 0, but that's 0 from 200.
Right. So, he asked the question, can you bank your hours and say, so this year I'm not doing any pro bono, but next year I'm going to cover for both years' worth, or something along those lines. And the answer is that from a Jewish law perspective, we create accounting periods, just like we do in accounting. And say, your accounting period starts here and ends here, and within that time you have to satisfy your obligations. Generally speaking, the accounting period that's used is 1 year, but there are authorities who actually go for shorter ones, who want you to make sure that you settle your account sooner. It's a matter of some debate within the field. So, to summarize what we've said, we started out with the question of whether a lawyer is allowed to charge at all, because you are helping other people, and we have a precedent in the realm of medicine for saying those who help others are not allowed to charge. However, we noted that that doesn't apply to all professions. We noted the case of the supermarket owner, the grocery owner, who's not obligated to give away his food or to sell it on credit just because there are people who are hungry for food. And we said that in practice, there are no sources that say a lawyer would not be allowed to charge for legal services, perhaps because legal representation is not generally viewed as life and death survival aid. Maybe that would be that would be why. We then moved into the discussion of pro bono and explained some of the history going back to Roman times through the church, through the Scottish law of 1424. We said there is no hard requirement in Ontario. There's this general striving for 50 hours a year, but that's really about it, which may be the 1 hour per week type of of an assessment. It could reflect the 7 hours calculation. I don't know. We said that pro bono comes from a personal value of philanthropy as well as a communal expectation of providing access to justice. We noted that within Judaism there's also the communal obligation of philanthropy that's separate from this. We noted other motivations as well, but I'll leave those on the side for the summary. We said that historically within the Jewish world, while you didn't have a system of legal aid the way you did within secular society, what you did have was the paying of judges from a communal tax in order to make sure that that people would have access to justice. We then move into the questions of government and lawyer. And we asked, is the community responsible to fund legal aid, or can it rely on the individual lawyers providing pro bono? And we said the government can expect lawyers to do a certain amount, and then it has to fund the rest. And if there's a sense that the pro bono services will be inferior, then the community can't rely on pro bono. It will be expected, indeed, to do more to provide access to justice. We then went to the question of the lawyer's personal obligations and how that affects pro bono decisions. And we said the expectation would be 10% of the hours that the lawyer has. In the event that the lawyer has more time to give, that could actually be accounted as part of their financial charity, their financial tzedakah as well. And in terms of prioritizing cases, we said the most dire need would come first, but should not necessarily be the sum of what one does. And local causes would come first as well. God willing, I will be uploading the audio, and I'll be sending out a link to that, along with the digital source sheet, as follow-up from the class. Thank you very much. I'm going to, as I said before in the beginning, I just want to make sure I re-announce two things. Number one, if you didn't sign in, please make sure that you do sign in, especially if you want credit for CPD. You do get 1.5 professionalism hours out of this. And then the second announcement is that I'm looking for professionalism topics to do next year, so I'll be asking in the email as well, please send me topics that that come to mind. And now I turn the floor over to Jeffrey. Thank you very much.